A lot of science is driven by the search for some kind of underlying order in the laws of the universe or the patterns of the stars or even in fish. And people can be remarkably persistent about trying to find it. Take the case of David Starr Jordan, the first president of Stanford University and the foremost ichthyologist of his time. He was credited with discovering nearly a fifth of the fish known to humans. And then, on Wednesday, April 18th, 1906, at 5:12 in the morning, the San Francisco earthquake struck. Much of the city was destroyed, including Jordan's vast collection of fish specimens.
Imagine seeing 30 years of your life undone in one instant. Imagine whatever it is you do all day, whatever it is you care about, whatever you foolishly pick and prod at each day, hoping against all signs that suggest otherwise, that it matters. Imagine finding all the progress you have made on that endeavor smashed and eviscerated at your feet. Those words go here. Fish were everywhere. Glass was strewn all over the floor. Flounders bashed further flat by fallen stone. Eels severed by shelves. Blowfish popped by shards of glass. There was a pungent smell of ethanol and corpse. But far worse than any of the carnal damage was the existential. For many of those specimens left intact, hundreds of them, nearly 1,000, their precious name tags had scattered all over the laboratory floor. In those 47 seconds, Genesis had been reversed. His meticulously named fish had become a confusion of unknown again.
Lulu Miller tells this story in her book, Why Fish Don't Exist. It's a meditation on the shadow side of scientific classification and on the dangers of trying too hard to impose order on chaos. Lulu's the former host of the NPR podcast Invisibilia, and she knows a great character when she meets one. David Starr Jordan was irresistible, a brilliant scientist, able to bounce back even after an earthquake destroyed his life's work. But he was also a man so obsessed with categorization and natural hierarchy that he became a proselytizer for eugenics and the quote-unquote cleansing of the gene pool. Shannon Henry Kleiber asked Lulu what first captivated her about him, and the answer? A visit to a San Francisco museum.
The tour guide just kind of offhandedly told the story. He pulled out, it was actually a hammerhead shark. He pulled it out of the tanks where it was being stored, and there was a label tied to its like eye tube sewn through the skin, and there was a label with its species name there. And he told us the story about how the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco destroyed a whole lot of the fish collection, and that the curator in charge of things afterwards invented this technique of tying labels directly to the specimen. And it was a small thing, but I remember standing there and thinking, oh, that's so human, that an earthquake would wreck your order and scatter the names everywhere. And your response would be, well, I'm going to invent a way to get back at you, chaos. And in that moment, it just struck me as the silliest thing to believe that you could outsmart all of chaos itself.
Wow. That earthquake, the 1906 San Francisco earthquake, 3,000 people were killed. It was 7.9 on the Richter scale. What was gained and lost that day for David Starr Jordan?
That's a really interesting way to ask it. What was gained and lost? What was lost were decades of work and meticulous ordering. And there were possibly even species that were lost to science because there were a few in there that hadn't yet been identified. But I think what was gained was shortly thereafter, he was so desperate to keep going and fight back against the chaos that kept invading his life, that he invented this new technique of sewing a specimen label directly to the creature itself. And so I think in a weird way, anytime this guy is hit with tragedy or destruction, it's almost always a moment of innovation.
So you had pinned kind of an idea on him, an idea of hope and inspiration, and then you got to know him better, as people do when you research and you're a biographer and a reporter and a detective, really, in a lot of ways in his story. Did he fulfill this idea of hope for you, or did he teach you something different?
He's so complicated. In certain ways, he did. He showed me a very different way to react to the sense that as a human, your chances are pretty doomed. He kind of showed me that blind confidence really can get you results. I think I went into it thinking that hubris, as the Greeks instruct, as my dad kind of instructed me growing up, was always dangerous and would ultimately lead to humiliation. And I think he shows the real potential, for better or for worse, that hubris can do you some concrete good. But there was also turned out to be a profoundly set of troubling things about him. There was some pretty intense bothness in there. Is that too vague? Is that okay?
No, I can totally picture you in these manuscript rooms and reading these books that you find, the Philosophy of Despair black book that you describe mm-hmm. so well, and all these different documents and letters, and thinking, oh, I understand him. I'm seeing this. And then there's a discovery, and it's beautiful in some ways. And then there's another discovery, and you're disappointed, and I felt bad for you.
Yeah. Well, it's what made it fun, though, because it's history. This guy is dead. But he was so vibrant. He was like this muscly snake that just kept moving in my hands. And he's full of charm. In certain ways, studying him actually felt really similar to making a radio piece, where you have a ton of tape and then you're whittling it down to like these gems mm-hmm. where someone's really funny or emotional or dark. He's vibrant. He is the full spectrum. He's charm. He's hilarious. He's dark, real dark.
He's an incredible character. He's hero and villain all in one, right?
Yes, exactly. Yes.
So what was the most surprising thing to you?
I think for me, just hands down, it was his life becomes intertwined with the eugenics movement. And going into this, I had no idea about our country's role in the eugenics movement. And I remember those early days of researching it and learning about just how we were a main player in the eugenics movement, this thing we would ultimately come to define our national identity in opposition to. We were actually crucial in getting the eugenics movement going.
The story you're writing about, the historical part, is very messy and unexpected and surprising and not easily tied up. And then you go into your story, which is also, like so many of us, messy and not easily explained. And it matches in a way.
Yeah, it does. I mean, that's just I've always had almost like a parable-shaped hole in my heart, growing up with a very atheist father, and then both of my parents were professors, so ambiguity really reigned in our home. Like, nothing means anything, or if it means something, it could mean many things. Like, there was just no moral instruction, and I think I've always had actually a craving for more. I think a lot of people grow up with moral instruction they come to find messed up, and then they want more ambiguity. But I'm one of these weirdos who actually wants more dogma. I don't know why it turned out this way, but I do. And that's part of what has always drawn me to storytelling. But as I've slowly, clumsily tried to become a better reporter and learned the art of reporting and realizing that story can actually be very dangerous in reporting, the sense of story, a clear moral, I have tried to ignore my cravings for moral clarity and black and white and actually really study the bothness.
Well, the way you bring things up, these different stories and characters, it is about curiosity, and you kind of go these different directions. Did it make you more curious as you worked on this?
Yeah, it totally did. The world as we know it is far less known than we think it is. It's so easy to think that we have a handle of everything now, that science knows, that we have it all mostly figured out. And maybe there's one new little bacteria that will be discovered, but basically we've got it down and how it works. And it's just, we're so far from that. We're just so deep at all times in the midst of these revolutions and paradigm shifts, and we're not done. We haven't arrived anywhere. We're at a clumsy, approximate best guess of our understanding of the world, and there is so much more waiting in the wings.
Even just the title, Why Fish Don't Exist, we think, okay, fish, I know what a fish is, but what does the title mean? Fish don't exist, it turns out.
Okay, I have a question for you. After reading it, do you think fish exist? Answer honestly.
So I think fish exist in a way that might not be the way we thought they did.
Yeah. I like that. I like that. Okay. To me, it is an example that just intersected with David's story in a really cool way, because he was a fish collector and ichthyologist, a person who studied the supposedly existent creature of fish. There has been a profound revolution in scientific circles of people who think about how to classify animals that pretty convincingly calls into question the existence of fish as a kind of creature. So it challenges the category of fish. And maybe that just sounds fussy, semantic distinction, who cares if your day job isn't a taxonomist. But for me, when you really think about what that means, and if you can do this mental scrunching required to let the category go, then some pretty profound things open up.
Lulu Miller is the former host of the NPR podcast Invisibilia, and she was talking with Shannon Henry Kleiber about her new book, Why Fish Don't Exist.